I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Biden Prevails. Democrat Joe Biden defeated President Donald Trump to become the 46th President of the United States on Saturday and offered himself to the nation as a leader who seeks not to divide but to unify a country gripped by a historic pandemic and confluence of economic and social turmoil. I sought this office to restore the soul of America, Biden said in a primetime victory speech not far from his Delaware home, and to make America respected around the world again and to unite us here at home. Biden crossed the winning threshold of 270 Electoral College votes with a win in Pennsylvania. His victory came after more than 3 days of uncertainty as election officials sorted through a surge of mail-in votes that delayed processing. Trump refused to concede, threatening further legal action on ballot counting, but Biden used his acceptance speech as an olive branch to those who did not vote for him, telling Trump voters that he understood their disappointment but adding, "Let's give each other a chance." It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, to lower the temperature, to see each other again, to listen to each other again, to make progress. We must stop treating our opponents as our enemy, he said. We are not enemies. We are all Americans. Biden, 77, staked his candidacy less on a distinctive political ideology than on galvanizing a broad coalition of voters around the notion that Trump posed an existential crisis, an existential threat to American democracy. The strategy, as well as an appeal to Americans fatigued by Trump's disruptions and wanting a return to more traditional presidency, proved effective and resulted in a pivotal victories in Michigan, Wisconsin, as well as Pennsylvania, one-time Democratic bastions that had flipped to Trump in 2016. Biden's victory was a repudiation of Trump's divisive leadership, and the president-elect now inherits a deeply polarized nation grappling with foundational questions of racial justice and economic fairness while in the grips of a virus that has killed more than 236,000 Americans and reshaped the norms of everyday life. Kamala Harris made history as the first black woman to become vice president, an achievement that comes as the U.S. faces a reckoning on racial justice. The California senator, who is also the first person of South Asian descent elected to the vice presidency, will become the highest-ranking woman ever to serve in government, 4 years after Trump defeated Hillary Clinton. Harris introduced Biden at their evening victory celebration as a president for all Americans, who would look to bridge a nation riven with partisanship as she nodded to the historic nature of her ascension to the vice presidency. Dream with ambition, lead with conviction, and see yourselves in a way that others may not simply because they've never seen it before, Harris told Americans. You chose hope and unity, decency, science, and yes, truth. You ushered a new day for America. After he spoke, the cars at the drive-in rally, a pandemic campaign invention, began to honk their horns and a firework display lit up the night sky. Biden was on track to win the national popular vote by more than 4 million, a margin that could grow as ballots continue to be counted. Nonetheless, Trump was not giving up. Departing from his long-standing Democratic tradition and signaling a potentially turbulent transfer of power, he issued a combative statement to saying his campaign would take unspecified legal actions. And he followed up with a bombastic all-caps tweet in which he falsely declared, "I won the election, got 71 million legal votes." Twitter immediately flagged it as misleading. Trump has pointed to delays in processing the vote in some states to alleged with no evidence that there was fraud and to argue that his rival was trying to seize power, an extraordinary charge by a sitting president trying to sow doubt about a bedrock democratic process. Trump is the first incumbent president to lose re-election since Republican George H.W. Bush in 1992. He was golfing at his Virginia Country Club when he lost the race. He stayed out for hours, stopping to congratulate a bride as he left, and his motorcade returned to the White House to a cacophony of shouts, taunts, and unfriendly hand gestures. In Wilmington, Delaware, near the stage that, until Saturday night, had stood empty since it was erected to celebrate on election night, People cheered and pumped their fists as the news that the presidential race had been called for the state's former senator arrived on their cell phones. On the nearby water, two men in a kayak yelled to a couple paddling in the opposite direction, "Joe won," they called it, as people on the shore whooped and hollered. Harris, in workout gear, was shown on video speaking to Biden on the phone, exuberantly telling the president-elect, "We did it." Biden was expected to take the stage for a drive-in rally after dark. Across the country, there were parties and prayer. In New York City, spontaneous block parties broke out. People ran out of their buildings, banging on pots. They danced and high-fived with strangers amid honking horns. Among the loudest cheers were those for passing U.S. Postal Service trucks. People streamed into Black Lives Matter Plaza near the White House, near where Trump had ordered the clearing of protesters in June, waving signs and taking cell phone pictures. In Lansing, Michigan, Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter demonstrators filled the Capitol steps. The lyrics to "Amazing Grace" began to echo through the crowd, and Trump supporters laid their hands on a counter-protester and prayed. Americans showed deep interest in the presidential race. A record 103 million voted early this year, opting to avoid waiting in long lines at polling locations during a pandemic. With counting continuing in some states, Biden has already received more than 75 million votes, more than any presidential candidate before him. Trump's refusal to concede has no legal implications, but it could add to the incoming administration's challenge of bringing the country together after a bitter election. Throughout the campaign, Trump repeatedly refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, arguing without evidence that the election could be marred by fraud. The nation has a long history of presidential candidates peacefully accepting the outcome of elections, dating back to 1800s when John Adams conceded to his rival Thomas Jefferson. It was Biden's native Pennsylvania that put him over the top, the state he invoked throughout the campaign to connect with the working class voters. He also won Nevada on Saturday, pushing his total to 290 Electoral College votes. Biden received congratulations from dozens of world leaders, and his former boss, President Barack Obama, saluted him in a statement declaring the nation was fortunate that Joe got what it takes to be president and already carries himself that way. Republicans on Capitol Hill were giving Trump and his campaign space to consider all their legal options. It was a precarious balance for Trump's allies as they tried to be supportive of the president and avoid risking further fallout, but face the reality of the vote count. On Saturday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had not yet made any public statements, either congratulating Biden or joining Trump's complaints. But retiring GOP Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is close to McConnell, said, "After counting every valid vote and allowing courts to resolve disputes, it's important to respect and promptly accept the result." Now for a similar article, "Trump Defied Gravity, But Future to Be Determined." Donald Trump, who defied political gravity with his extraordinary rise from reality star and businessman to the presidency, has fallen back to earth. In the end, his flurry of raucous rallies, an unprecedented turnout operation, and sheer force of will could not overcome the reality of his enduring unpopularity and a raging pandemic that has killed more than 236,000 people in the U.S. and thrown millions out of work. Yet Trump's acerbic brand of politics, his Twitter taunts and vindictive drive to punish enemies, his go-it-alone approach to the world, made its mark across the far reaches of the government and beyond. His better-than-expected election performance against Democrat Joe Biden suggests his impact is likely to resonate for generations in politics, governing, and policy, even in defeat. It remains to be seen what Trump intends to do after his term ends on January 20th. Retreat to the golf course? Launch his own television network, lay the groundwork to run again, and how fiercely will he try to contest his fate? I would absolutely expect the president to stay involved in politics. I would absolutely put him on the short list of people who are likely to run in 2024. Trump's former chief of staff, Mike Mulvaney, said in an online interview with the Institute of International and European Affairs, he doesn't like losing. Trump retains the megaphone of his Twitter account, a far-reaching Fox News platform, and the unflinching backing of his loyal base of supporters who may never accept his defeat after he spent months insisting that there was no way he could legitimately lose and even falsely claimed premature victory. On Saturday, Trump declined to concede to President-elect Biden, instead promising unspecified legal challenges to try to overturn the outcome of the race. Until the successor emerges to lead Republicans, likely not until the resolution of the 2024 Republican primary, Trump remains the de facto head of a party that he has reshaped in his image. Even in defeat, Donald Trump has exceeded expectations and helped other Republicans do the same, said GOP consultant Michael Steele, who has worked on Capitol Hill and for campaigns. He'll remain a powerful force within the party. Still, Trump's loss is likely to spark a reckoning over how much of Trumpism the party should embrace going forward, especially given that Republicans could still retain control of the Senate and win additional seats in the House. Had Biden won in a blowout, that would have put wind in the back of a lot of Republicans who said character counts and the Republican Party should never put its faith in someone who pushed boundaries like Donald Trump, said former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, who served under former President George W. Bush. But because it was closer, he predicted the party would likely continue to be racked with a split between insiders and outsiders, between the establishment and the Trump supporters who fault the establishment. And the soon-to-be former president's role will be a huge question mark, because if he decides to stay active, despite the close loss, he remains powerful and effective, especially for Republicans. In the meantime, it remains unclear whether Trump will accept the result of the election as he spends the next 3 months as a lame duck president. Those who know him well say there is a little chance he will go quietly into the night. When Donald Trump loses, there will never be a peaceful transition to power, said Trump's longtime lawyer and fixer-turned-critic Michael Cohen. He predicted Trump would do everything in his power to claim the election was stolen from him by Democrats or other forces, just as Trump tried to sow discord as the votes were being counted. Cohen said Trump was also likely aware that after losing the presidency, he might be served with a plethora of lawsuits, both federal and state. Trump is already facing lawsuits that accuse him of sexual assault and defamation, and Trump's organization's finances are being investigated by New York's Attorney General. Barbara Ress, a longtime Trump associate who recently wrote a book about her experience working with him, speculated the president might leave the country before Biden's inauguration and perhaps pursue his own media empire. He could put on whatever he wants. He could say whatever he wants. It's almost like having Twitter explode into everything else, she said. Regardless of what he does, Douglas Brinkley, a professor of history at Rice University, said Trump would likely go down as an aberration in U.S. political history. One-term presidents are rare. There's a great advantage to being an incumbent, and Trump squandered it, he said, arguing that Trump would likely be seen as an insurgent figure, even though 25% of the American public will always see Donald Trump as their Rambo and John Wayne figure combined. As for the future for Republicans, Steele said the party would likely look to leaders who combine elements of Trump's populist agenda with policies that appeal to a broader swath of the electorate. The challenge will be identifying the popular, durable, and practical parts of his agenda and marrying them to policies and arguments that appeal to the broader electorate that the party will need to win at the national level in the future, he said. Now on to the article, several key steps remain to formally elect the president. Saturday's election verdict isn't the last step in selecting an American president. Under a system that's been tweaked over two centuries, there is still a weeks-long timeline during which the 538-member Electoral College picks the president. Here's how it works. The Electoral College is the body that elects the president and the vice president. Citizens cast their ballot for a ticket that includes a president and vice president, but the voters are actually voting for electors who make up the Electoral College. which then cast votes for a candidate. Those electors, in most cases, are committed to support the voter's candidate of choice. State laws vary on how electors are selected, but generally, a slate of selectors for each party's candidate is chosen at a state's party convention or by a vote of the party's central committee. Each state is entitled to a number of electors equal to the number equal to that state's representation in Congress. Each state gets 2 senators and a number of House of Representative members. The total number of senators and representatives would be the number of electors each state receives. Most states are on the winner-takes-all basis. There are a couple of states, Nebraska and Maine, that reward electoral votes in the proportional representation. 51% or more of the votes are needed for the candidate to win all of the state's electors. Electors are added up. A simple majority of 270 is needed to win the election. Finally, on the Monday following the second Wednesday of December, the electors meet in their capitals and cast their official votes. Let's move on to the article, Local Hospitals Are Full. Officials beg public to wear mask in face of pandemic fatigue. Unity Point Health Allen Hospital is filled to capacity, with Mercy One saying the situation has become critical as people disregard basic health protocols amid pandemic fatigue in the Cedar Valley. Hospitals across the state are worked to their breaking point. Unlike the area's first coronavirus surge in the spring, fueled by employees at a meatpacking plant and their close contacts, the virus is being transmitted widely among a larger percentage of the population now, leading to bed shortages and staff illnesses and absenteeism. "It's starting to get dire," said Dr. Matthew Soika, chief medical officer of the Mercy One Northeast Iowa. So dire, in fact, Unity Point sent out a statement begging the public to take public health measures seriously to avoid a situation where local hospitals have to pick and choose whom to serve. "It's crucial for the public to understand that the challenges we are facing are very real and urgent," the statement said. "The entire Unity Point health system is seeing an increase in COVID-19 hospitalizations." The statement came as Iowa reported another 4,249 coronavirus cases Saturday. It's not just COVID-19 patients filling up hospital beds, though. They account for a significant portion. It's also people with chronic or other serious conditions who may have put off care in the early months of the pandemic, said Dr. Russell Adams, chief medical officer at Unity Point Health Waterloo Region. "Each week, it seems to be getting worse," Adams said, "and November's surge is much different than April's. In late March and early April, a surge in cases attributed to Tyson Fresh Meats in Waterloo inundated Blackhawks County hospitals. Hospitals drew on staff from other areas and sent sick people to other less affected hospitals. Now, all hospitals in Iowa are facing surges. That means no extra beds and no extra staff, as providers themselves are catching the coronavirus outside hospitals at higher rates than before. It's happening throughout the country now, so where do we get that extra nurse, those extra physicians?" Soika asked. Soika wouldn't say how many Mercy One staffers are affected, but Adams said that 88 employees of Unity Point are out on COVID-19 protocol. "When we have a surge like this, it affects us from capacity to capability," he said. "Both hospital systems are so far managing the surge, not having to divert patients to other facilities yet. But there is no guarantee that that will hold true, particularly with the increasing number of cases. I'm worried," Soika said. "A month ago, there were about 20 new cases a day in Blackhawk County. Now there are about 120 cases a day. In 1 month, there has been much of an increase. The 4,249 new Iowa cases recorded from 10 a.m. Friday to 10 a.m. Saturday brought the state's total since the pandemic began to 148,391. The number of deaths also increased by 14 to 1,829. On Saturday, the state was reporting 901 hospitalizations, down from 912 on Friday. In the past 24 hours, 165 patients have been admitted. Also, there are 194 patients in the ICU, up from 188 on Friday. The good news, local officials said, is that there was still time to turn things around. Wearing a face mask in public places, being socially distant, washing your hands, and being cautious about spending time where people aren't doing these things are all at the top of Adam's list. You may feel great, but you may have COVID, and you may give it to someone else, and that someone else is more susceptible to complications, Adam said. That's the challenge we have, is to counteract that. Soyka agreed that it will take more people taking the virus seriously to have any chance of the hospital stopping the surge. We've got to slow this down before it overwhelms all of the health systems, not only in the Cedar Valley, but all over the state and the country, he said. Now on to the article, Waterloo Considers Extending Mask Mandate. The City Council Monday will consider extending Waterloo's mask mandate another 6 weeks. The mandates stay in effect for 6 weeks before they must be reconsidered by council members, according to the previous resolutions. The initial mask guidelines were approved on a 6-1 vote in late August. An extension was approved 4-2 in mid-September. Like previous resolutions, the proposed extension requires people to wear masks inside public buildings such as grocery stores and city facilities. The mandate would continue requiring people to wear masks when outside if 6 feet distance is not possible and when using transportation services. People with certain health conditions, children under 2, and public safety employees are exempt. Other exemptions exist for people who are alone, with a household member, exercising, eating, or drinking. The proposed extension comes shortly after Black Hawk County moved from moderate to high risk for the virus. The classification is given when there is more than 100 cases per 100,000 people in the last week, and a more than 10% 14-day average positivity rate. As of Friday, the county had a 22.6 positivity rate. The positivity rate is calculated by dividing the number of cases testing positive by the total number tested. Councilmember Margaret Klein and David Boson voted against the last extension, citing a lack of enforcement of the mandate. Klein, who also voted against the initial guidelines in August, said wearing a mask should be an individual choice. I think we are becoming too much of a nanny state, Klein said. Councilmember Jonathan Greider said the mandate can slow the spread of the virus, which has now resulted in more than 100 county deaths. He called the mandate the smart, scientific, neighborly thing to do. Residents who want to comment on the proposed extension can email the city clerk office. People can attend Monday's meeting at 5:30 p.m. in City Hall, or they can contact the clerk to receive login information and to attend via Zoom or phone call. Let's go on to the article, Test Iowa Site Opening at UNI Amidst Rapid Growth in Campus COVID-19 Cases. A state COVID-19 testing site will open at the University of Northern Iowa as officials strive to enhance existing on-campus capabilities amidst rapid growth in positive cases. The Test Iowa site will be established within UNI's Student Health Center during the week. The center currently provides testing services for students and employees who have potentially been exposed to the coronavirus. UNI is partnering with Test Iowa in our continued efforts to enhance the Student Health Clinic's testing program, Steve Schumadike, UNI's public relations manager, said in a written response to questions. Since July, UNI has offered COVID-19 testing to our students, faculty, and staff. In October, the university introduced a new rapid testing program, and November's rollout with Test Iowa is a natural progression in our effort to expand testing on our campus. The health center has reported growing percentages of positive COVID-19 cases among the tests it has given during the recent weeks. The positivity rate hit 38.42% over a 4-day period ending Thursday. Central personnel administered 203 tests between Monday and Thursday. That compares with less than 140, and often far fewer usually given in a week. 78 of the tests are positive. UNA updates its weekly COVID-19 numbers through an online dashboard every Thursday and Monday. The total was more than double the recent high point of 32 positive cases during the week ending November 1st, which translated to a positivity rate of 26.02%. It also exceeded the previous high in the number of cases and the positivity rate during the week ending August 30th. There were 54 new cases that week, with a positivity rate of 32.14%. Along with the positive cases, UNI's Department of Residence reported Friday that 26 students were in quarantine and fewer than 6 were in isolation on campus. With 2.5 weeks left in a compressed fall semester, Provost Jim Wolpart reflected anxiety about the growth of coronavirus cases in a Friday email to faculty, intended to encourage them to finish strong before an extended break. The email, obtained by the Courier, said, "We are in the beginning of the dark night right now as COVID-19 cases increase. We are watching the numbers go up around the country, the state, and in our county," Wolpart wrote, "and the numbers are going up on our campus because we are all going out in public at some point. Our positivity rate is going to increase partly because we have more positive cases and partly because our testing ability is limited." He noted some hope for a reprieve from those limits with the Test Iowa site opening on campus. Schumodyke said that, despite such comments, there is not a problem with capacity for testing on campus. "Students who qualify for testing with the Iowa Department of Public Health criteria have been tested," he said. "We have not turned anyone away as we have an ample supply of tests available." College students who have a fever, cough, or difficulty breathing and don't have an alternative diagnosis meet the criteria. Others with these symptoms who meet the criteria include college students living in dormitories and college staff without other diagnosis. People with or without symptoms who have spent more than 15 minutes within 6 feet of someone with a positive case also meet the criteria. "For UNI students or staff who don't meet those criteria," Schumodyke said, "we suggest that they go through the Test Iowa website to see if they qualify for a test with them." Students who are tested off campus have their information shared with Blackhawk County Health Department, and when they provide this information to the student health clinic, so the campus can contact tracers and work these cases, he explained. "We do not track this information, but is documented in the individual student's medical record." Along with the health center numbers, UNI reported Friday that there were 37 new self-reported COVID-19 cases between Monday and Thursday. That includes 26 students and 11 employees. Some of them may duplicate the health center's numbers. Becky Haubaker, president of the United Faculty Bargaining Group and a member of UNI's COVID-19 response team, agrees that there is no shortage of tests on campus. She suggests some may be misreading Wolpart's intent in the email, noting it affirms faculty members' rights to do what they see as necessary to keep safe while finishing the semester. "His message is what United Faculty has said all along," she commented. Haubaker pointed to the paragraph where Wolpart encourages faculty to do something different if needed, like move a class online after talking to their department head. "For me as a union leader, the priority is, do the faculty feel safe and are they empowered to take steps to protect themselves," she said. As COVID-19 infections have risen at UNI, Haubaker said she is reassured about classroom safety because none of those cases can be traced to on-campus community spread. Largely, they relate to off-campus activity according to the data she has seen. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for November the 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Jeff P. Free, 61, of Dubuque, formerly of Waterloo, died Tuesday, November 3rd, at Unity Point Health, Finley Hospital in Dubuque, of cancer. He was born October 19th, 1959, son of James and Mona Schmitz-Free. He graduated from Waterloo Columbus High School in 1978 and received his bachelor's degree in business from UNI. He married Julie Neese on June 19, 2014, in Emmitsburg. He is survived by his wife of Dubuque, mother of Waterloo, two sisters, Peg Jasper of Maple Grove, Minnesota, and Mary Weber of Raymond. Her two brothers, Jim Free, Jr. and Tom Free, both of Waterloo, nine nieces and nephews, and seven great-nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his father, sister-in-law, Sharon Free, and niece, Jenny Free. Memorial service, 11 a.m., Tuesday, November 10th, at Garden View Chapel, with interment in Mount Olivet Cemetery, both in Waterloo. Visitation 1 hour prior to the service. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Donald J. Pierce. Donald John Pierce, of 91, of Waterloo, passed away Friday, October 16th, 2020, at his home with his family. Don was born September 2nd, 1929, in Eagle Center, son of Aloysius and Mary Reuter Pierce. My apologies for the pronunciation. He married Marianne Bruskern April 14th, 1953. They married after Don returned home from serving in the U.S. Navy. Don was the owner of Pierce Used Cars for over 50 years. He enjoyed his career working on cars and helping his many customers. Don worked at Rath Packing Company. After leaving Rath, he worked at John Deere, third shift, and Pierce Used Cars very long days to lovingly support his family. He took early retirement from John Deere to solely focus on his business. He is survived by his daughters, Deborah Suzanne of Madison, Wisconsin, Danette Sutton of Brandon, Delana Pierce of Marion, son David Pierce of Waterloo, daughter-in-law Judy Pierce of Waterloo, four grandchildren, Josh Dugan, Nate Pierce, Courtney Hopkins, and Braxton Pierce, seven great-grandchildren, Taylor and Beckett Dugan, Maddox and Huxon Pearson Grant, Berkeley and Barrett Hopkins, and his sisters, Jan Burns, Marcella Schmidt, and Alice Barr. Don was preceded in death by his wife of 62 years, a son Daniel, and his daughter Delana Baller, parents Al and Mary Pierce, sisters Aline Sharons and Caroline Pierce, and brothers Jim and Ray Pierce. There will be a celebration of life gathering and luncheon 1 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 15th at the Shine House, 2021 Howard Drive, Waterloo, Iowa. Arrangements by Iowa Cremation Society. Online condolences may be made at www.iowacremation.com. Dr. Ronald Roberts. Ronald E. Roberts passed away on October 29th, 2020, of COVID-related complications at Ravenwood Specialty Care, Waterloo, Iowa. He had been a resident at Ravenwood for the past 5 years after experiencing a stroke. Ronald was born to May and Everett Roberts on July 31st, 1939, in Sheraton, Iowa. His family moved to East Moline, Illinois, where Ron lived his first 9 years. The family returned to his father's hometown of Lucas, Iowa, where Ron was to later graduate from high school. Ron attended Graceland College, graduated from Drake University with a bachelor's degree, and earned his master's and Ph.D. degrees from Louisiana State University. Ron, then his wife, Patricia, sons Alan and Nick, relocated to Cedar Falls, Iowa, in 1969. He worked as a sociology professor at the University of Northern Iowa from 1969 to 2001. Ron was an avid reader, prolific writer on sociological issues and the human experience, lecturer, and an activist for the oppressed and powerless. Growing up in southern Iowa, he witnessed the lower social economic strife and felt compelled to be a champion for those less fortunate. His loving and very close-knit family of origin helped to instill these values. He often told the story of meeting John L. Lewis, United Miners president, in Lucas as a young boy. His father told him that he had just been a great man, and Ron responded to his father, "He is no better than you." Ron would later become an author about John L. Lewis, coal mining, and his childhood town of Lucas, Iowa. He was instrumental in helping to make John L. Lewis Museum in Lucas a reality. Ron contributed many articles and artifacts to the museum, as well as giving talks about Lewis and Lucas. Ron was generous to a fault to those who were struggling financially or those who needed a place to stay, sometimes to his detriment. Ron's ability to relate and connect with people of various social, cultural, and educational backgrounds was an admirable trait. His students, friends, and family were entertained by his highly original humor. Some former students remarked to his family that he was a favorite professor at UNI, as he challenged their thinking and fostered personal growth. Besides being an avid reader, Ron enjoyed traveling abroad to many countries, socializing with his lifelong friends and colleagues, viewing movies, biking, riding in the Iowa Ragbri, and marathon running in his younger years. During later adulthood, he attended the Quakers for numerous years. Ron is survived by his sister Kay, who always adored her older brother, his loving son Alan and wife Sherry, granddaughters Morgan and Hannah, nephews Sean McGee, Corey McGee, and his wife Marianne, brother-in-law Terry, great-nephew and niece Logan and Avery, as well as lifelong friend John Nygaard and former wife Carol. A special thanks to his professor friends, Jerry Stockdale, Tom Hill, Joe Wells, and Larry Gordon, who visited and supported Ron during his illness. As his last act as a citizen, he proudly exercised the right to cast his vote against the current tyranny. Ron was preceded in death by his parents, Everett and May, and son Forrest. May they rest in peace. Private family service will be held at a later date. Services was planned by Fielding Funeral Homes in Sheraton, Iowa. Memorials may be sent to John L. Lewis Museum, 102 Division St. Street, Lucas, Iowa, 50151. Now back to some news articles. Let's start with U.S. sets daily record in cases. Number over 126,400. Europe is pondering essentials and pandemic. The United States set a record of more than 126,400 confirmed cases in a single day on Friday. The 7-day rolling average of new daily cases in the U.S. is approaching 100,000 for the first time, according to the data from the Johns Hopkins University. Total U.S. cases since the start of the pandemic are nearing 10 million, and confirmed cases globally are approaching 50 million. Worldwide infection numbers are also setting records. The world reached 400,000 daily confirmed cases on October 15th, 500,000 on October 26th, and 600,000 on Friday. The 7-day rolling average for daily deaths in the U.S. rose in the past 2 weeks from 772 on October 23rd to 911 on Friday. Those numbers were higher in the spring and August. The global death toll hit a daily record of 11,024 confirmed deaths on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the concept of what is essential to keep a society functioning during coronavirus lockdowns is gripping Europe as the pandemic unleashes death, poverty, illness, and isolation. Beyond obvious candidates like food stores and pharmacies, some answers in the patchwork of nations and cultures that make up Europe can approach the surreal. An activity or item considered essential in one country can be off-limits across the border just a brief stroll down the road. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that while it might seem fairest to just shut everything down, it is perhaps not the most practical solution. If people are only satisfied when everything possible is shut down, then that's a view which naturally doesn't make economic sense, Merkel said. That's why Germany is keeping car dealerships open at this time. After their closure than the first time, a spring lockdown hurt the country's huge automobile industry. In Belgium, of course, chocolate shops are staying open. Chocolate is very much an essential food around here, said chocolatier Marlene van Volsum at the Praline Chocolatier south of Brussels. Also, Italy registered a record of 39,811 daily confirmed coronavirus cases on Saturday. That tops the 37,809 cases on Friday. In Lombardy, one quarter of the coronavirus tests came back positive, for a daily total of nearly 11,500. Lombardy is one of the four regions designated a red zone, with a partial lockdown in effect since Friday. Hospitalizations continue to rise, with 1,104 more hospitalized on Saturday, and 119 more in intensive care. There are more than 862,000 total confirmed cases in Italy. Deaths nationwide rose by 425 for a confirmed total of 41,063, sixth highest in the world. In other developments, Malaysia's government said Saturday it would expand movement restrictions to most parts of the country, with coronavirus cases nearly tripling over the past month. Another 1,168 new cases were reported Saturday, bringing Malaysia's total tally to 39,357, compared to just 13,993 a month ago. More than 20,000 people demonstrated Saturday in eastern Germany against the government's imposed restrictions meant to slow the spread of the coronavirus after a court rejected the city of Leipzig's attempt to move the protest away from the central square, police said. Let's go on to the article, ACA Support in Doubt. Justices set to review health law Tuesday with Barrett on court. Until 6 weeks ago, defenders of the Affordable Care Act could take comfort in some simple math. Five Supreme Court justices who had twice preserved the Obama-era health care law remained on the bench and seemed unlikely votes to dismantle it. But Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death in mid-September and her replacement by Amy Coney Barrett barely a month later have altered the equation as the court prepares to hear arguments Tuesday in the third major legal challenge in the law's 10-year existence. Republican attorneys generals in 18 states, backed by the Trump administration, are arguing that the whole law should be struck down because of a change made by the Republican-controlled Congress in 2017 that reduced the penalty for not having health insurance to zero. A court ruling invalidating the entire law would threaten coverage for more than 23 million people. It would wipe away protections for people with pre-existing medical conditions, subsidized insurance premiums that make coverage affordable for millions of Americans, and an expansion of the Medicaid program that is available to low-income people in most states. No portion of the ACA is servable from the mandate, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton told the court in a written filing. The Republicans are pressing the position even though congressional efforts to repeal the entire law have failed, including in July 2017, when then-Arizona Senator John McCain delivered a traumatic thumbs-down vote to a repeal effort by fellow Republicans. Barrett is one of three appointees of President Donald Trump who will be weighing the latest legal attack on the law popularly known as Obamacare. Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brent Kavanaugh are the others. It's their first time hearing a major case over the health law as justices, although Kavanaugh took part in the first round of lawsuits over when he was a federal appeals court judge. Of the other justices, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Stephen Breyer Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor have voted to uphold the law. Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas have voted for strike it all down. The practical effects of the repeal of the tax penalty have surprised many healthcare policy experts. They predicted that getting rid of the penalty would lead over time to several million people dropping coverage, mostly healthier enrollees, and as a result, premiums for the law's subsidized private insurance would rise because of the remaining customers would tend to be in poorer health. But that hasn't appeared to happen, at least not yet. Enrollment in the law's insurance markets stayed relatively stable, but at more than 11 million people, even after the effective date of the penalty's elimination in 2019. According to the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation, enrollment dropped by about 300,000 people from 2018 to 2019. A decision is expected by late spring. Now, let's go on to some sports. Let's start with the article, Goodson Rushes for 113 Yards as Iowa Wallops Michigan State. If there had been a crowd at Kinnick Stadium on Saturday, it wouldn't have had the chance to settle into its seats before Iowa let its intentions be known. Frustrated by the program's first 0-2 start in two decades, the Hawkeyes pounced on Michigan State early, often in nearly every way imaginable, to roll to a 49-7 victory. From an offense that crafted drives of 75 and 74 yards to score on its first two possessions, to a defense that ended the Spartans' opening drive with the first of its three interceptions and special teams that repeatedly left Michigan State with miserable field position and even contributed to a touchdown, determined Iowa was focused from the start. We talked all week about showing up at 11:02 ready for the kickoff, and certainly we did that, quarterback Spencer Petras said following his first win as the Hawkeyes' starting quarterback. Offense, defense, special teams, everybody came ready to play. It was a total team effort. Petras orchestrated a turnover-free, balanced offensive attack that piled up to 405 yards, including a season-high 226 yards on the ground. The Iowa defense was equally dominant, limiting Michigan State to 59 rushing yards and rattling quarterback Rocky Lombardi's world. The Hawkeyes intercepted the junior from West Des Moines Valley three times, sacked him twice, and limited him to a 17 of 37 passing performance for a season-low 227 yards. Riley Moss returned one of the pick's 54 yards for a score late in the second quarter, seconds after Charlie Jones ran a punt back 54 yards for a touchdown that helped the Hawkeyes open a 35-0 lead by halftime. Second-half touchdowns run of 2 and 6 yards by McKee Sargent added to the margin of victory that was Iowa's largest against a Big Ten opponent since a 63-0 win at Illinois in 2018, and it's most lopsided at Kinnick Stadium in league play since a 62-10 win over Northwestern in 2002. This was everything we could have hoped for, said Iowa coach Kirk Fertinez, who passed Penn State's Joe Petrino to sit alone in the fourth on the Big Ten wins list with the 163rd victory with a conference program. The guys played tough, played physical, and all three segments played well and really complemented each other. It was the type of well-rounded effort the Hawkeyes had been working toward after dropping their first two games by a combined 5 points. To be so close, we knew if we kept working, took care of the details, we'd get over the hump, Iowa offensive tackle Alaric Jackson said. Even before Lombardi threw the first of his three first-half interceptions, Iowa had opened a 7-0 lead, and it wouldn't relinquish. The Hawkeyes marched 75 yards on 8 plays to open the game, blending the run and pass with equal efficiency to grab an early lead on a 3-yard touchdown run by Goodson, just under 4 minutes into the game. This team was eager to come out and dominate the first drive, Goodson said. It gave us the confidence to push through the full game. The touchdown run was the first of two for Goodson, who collected a team-high 113 of Iowa's 226 rushing yards. The sophomore scored on a 9-yard carry with 11 minutes and 16 seconds to play before halftime, extending the 14-0 advantage the Hawkeyes had taken in the first quarter on the 14-yard touchdown reception by Brandon Smith. An interception by Jack Coriner set up the 10-play, 74-yard drive, a turnover that provided only a hint of things to come. Barrington Wade and Moss wrapped their arms around Lombardi passes as well in the opening half, sending Iowa into the locker room with a 35-0 halftime lead. We knew if we could get some pressure on Lombardi, stop the run, we could do what we enjoy doing and get the passer out of his game and make him throw some balls up, Iowa defensive Chauncey Goldston said. Moss returned his interception 54 yards, matching the distance Jones had returned a punt 27 seconds earlier for a touchdown, as Iowa special teams and defense helped blow the game open. The pick six by Moss, with 1 minute and 30 seconds to go in the half, gave the Hawkeyes an interception return for a score for the 13th straight season, and the Jones return was Iowa's first punt return for a touchdown since Kyle Groenwig returned 161 yards for a score during a 2018 game at Illinois. The whole first half, it was the start we were looking for, Moss said. Our preparation, all week, it was the best week we've had this year, and it carried over. Guys were flying around in practice, and we were excited to play this game, to come out, and to get that first win. Now onto the article, College Football, Cyclones Rally to Improve to 5-1. Iowa State looked like a Big 12 Conference leading team in the second half against Baylor. The Cyclones scored 28 unanswered points in the second half and beat the Bears 38-31. Iowa State's lead in the Big 12 with a 5-1 conference record. Oklahoma State is also a one-loss conference team with a 4-1 conference record. This is the first time in program history that the Cyclones have started a conference season 5-1. Iowa State dug itself a hole in the first half due to three Brock Purdy interceptions, including one that was a pick six by Baylor's Jaylene Pitre. Baylor scored touchdowns off the other interceptions as well. And to begin the second half, Iowa State's defense forced a three and out, but punter returner Greg Ainsworth muffed the punt to give Baylor excellent field position. The Bears were forced to settle for a field goal, but led the Cyclones 24-10. That's when Iowa State's offense turned into a juggernaut. Running back Breece Hall rushed for over 100 yards for the seventh time this season. He finished with 133 yards and two rushing touchdowns on 31 carries. He also caught two passes for 27 yards and a touchdown. Purdy, who struggled mightily in the first half, completing just 6 of his 11 pass attempts and throwing 3 interceptions, turned it around in the second half. He completed 9 of his 11 pass attempts in the second half for 108 yards and 3 touchdowns. 8 different Iowa State receivers caught passes, led by tight end Charlie Kolar, who had 3 catches for 45 yards and a touchdown. Defensively, Iowa State was dominant in the second half and forced Baylor into four 3-and-outs to begin the half. Baylor gained just 22 yards in the third quarter. The defense was undoubtedly led by Mike Rose, who only makes big plays for the Cyclones. The linebacker had the game-clinching interception in the end zone as Baylor was trying to tie the game with 57 seconds left in the fourth quarter. On top of his third interception of the season, he also had a team-high 11 tackles, as well as 1.5 tackles for a loss and 2 QB hurries. In the first half, defensive back Tavron Kyle, my apologies for the mispronunciation, helped keep the Cyclones in the game with an interception of his own in the first quarter. That interception led to the eventual Hall touchdown, which kept Iowa State in the game in the first half. Defensive lineman Inai Uvzreich, my apologies for the pronunciation, had a big game of his own, recording 5 tackles, 2 tackles for a loss and a sack. Not to be overlooked, Iowa State's special teams came through in a big way.
Kenny Nwangu had a 67-yard kick return in the third quarter that set up an Iowa State touchdown. Landon Akers also blocked a punt in the third quarter, which he recovered on the 11-yard line, which also led to an easy Iowa State touchdown. Iowa State is going into its final bye week of the season and controls its own destiny. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for November the 8th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.